helping with the kids today, which is great because it means I can start with a story that involves Heidi and she won't get embarrassed. So we dated through much of college, and one summer, we went down to a town called Santiago Atitlan in Guatemala. And we were working with a women's organization there. We were organizing some children's kind of art and Spanish language acquisition classes, and we were playing a lot of Duck, Duck, Goose, which was tons of fun. One day, we're at this community house, perhaps. That community house. And we're playing with the kids. We're doing our afternoon session, and suddenly this just firecracker of a short, elderly Latina woman walks in the door and stares at us with these eyes that could, like, kill you, and tells us we have to get out of there because she has a group of Swedish donors coming to do a Mayan ceremony in this room, and she can't have the kids running around and causing a mess, right? So we can do our thing, we just can't do it there. Now, Antonia, the president of the women's organization that we worked with, had told us all about this woman. This, we knew, was Elbita. And Elbita, we had been told, was a woman who had worked in the community for a while, but several years ago had started collecting international donations and not giving them to the women's organization. So she was fundraising on their behalf, but the money wasn't showing up. So needless to say, we didn't have a great attitude towards Elbita when she walked in and told us to get out. We were already kind of primed not to be well disposed to her. So we, and by that I mean really Heidi, because she is much bolder than I am, proceeded to stand up for our project, for these kids and these women's right to use this community house. And there was a bit of a shouting match in Spanish, which between Heidi and Elbita was a sight to behold. These are not women to be taken lightly. Eventually, however, Elbita's machine gun Spanish won out over Heidi, who was still studying the language, and we left. We gave up. We had to cancel the event for that afternoon, and Elbita got to have her Mayan ceremony with the Swedish donors. Now, not long after this, through a series of interviews that Heidi was doing with women from the group and conversations with community leaders, we found something out. It was not Elbita who had been stealing. In fact, it was Antonia, the woman who had told us that Elbita was stealing. Elbita was indeed collecting donations and not giving them to Antonia, but precisely because Antonia was stealing them. She was directing the money elsewhere. And Antonia was none too happy about this. So, as it turned out, every accusation that we had angrily flung at Elbita in this argument was false. Patently false. This was bad. Now, stop for a minute. Put yourself in Elbita's shoes. I've been telling the story from our perspective. But you show up to do what you do, and these arrogant young foreigners suddenly start accusing you of, frankly, crimes in front of the very people you're trying to impress. You are being slandered, and there's really nothing you can do about it. You spent decades of your life working for the indigenous population of Guatemala. You've been threatened. You've been kidnapped once, actually. And now these kids are accusing you of exploiting precisely the people who you've dedicated your life to for your own personal gain. Think for a minute about this. What would you do? Perhaps you'd be furious. I think I would be. Perhaps you'd maybe look for a way to tell this town just how ignorant these kids were, to point out what a horrible job they're doing, and to discredit their work. Maybe instead you'd pretend. You know, it hadn't really bothered you. After all, you're so good and important that you can't be hurt by such bad and unimportant people as this, right? Brush it off. I know I kind of like to take that route. I'm bigger than this. It wasn't a big deal. And these are all, I think, really rather understandable and probably normal responses to have in a situation like the one Elbita was in. But there is another possibility. So, in the earliest decades of the Christian faith, a man named Paul, who had founded a church in a Greek city called Corinth, wrote a letter to this community. The community was having problems, internal conflicts, tons of issues. Some of them were so bad that some of the community members were taking each other to court. They were going to the Roman courts to solve their disputes. Here's what Paul, or at least part of what Paul had to say to them. He said, "In fact, to have lawsuits at all with one another is already a defeat for you. Why not rather be wronged? Why not rather be defrauded?" What a radical and really, frankly, unnerving and scary possibility that is. Why not rather forgive the grievance than get your compensation? Why not recognize that you have been wronged and forgive? Now, the suggestion from Paul, I think, accords with a theme we find throughout much of this Christian scriptures. A couple other examples that I looked at were in the letter to the church in a city called Ephesus. This church is challenged to be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, as God in Christ has forgiven you. They're called not to dwell on things, not to get what is their due, but to forgive, because that is what God has done for them. Peter, an early follower of Jesus, it's recorded in the Gospel of Matthew, once asked, "Lord, how often should I forgive? As many as 7 times? And Jesus responded, "Not 7 times, but I tell you, 77 times. And I take it the point here is not that 77 is the magic number, but that as far as counting forgiveness goes, that's out of the question. You just got to keep going. So forgiveness, it seems, is a possibility that maybe we want to take seriously. Maybe we want to consider it. But what exactly does it entail? Before you jump on the train and say, yes, forgiveness, what are you getting on board for? So let's think about some characteristics of forgiveness. First, forgiveness is inherently social. It involves relationships. There have to be at least 2 parties for somebody to forgive somebody else. It also presupposes that one of these parties has committed a wrong against the other. Somebody has harmed someone in some way. And I'm going to bracket for the moment the question how we know whether a wrong in fact has been committed or whether somebody feels that they've been wronged but they haven't. That is a sticky issue that's beyond the scope. Now, the thing that happens when there's a wrong in a relationship is it damages the relationship somehow. You could picture it as something of a break, or maybe it's an obstacle in the way of good relationship. Whatever it is, when a wrong occurs, there's something that's impeding, something that's affecting the relationship in a negative way. What forgiveness does is name that wrong for what it is. Forgiveness is not the route of pretending it wasn't a problem. Forgiveness is honest. Forgiveness presupposes that there's something to forgive. If you think about it, to forgive something that's not a wrong is just nonsense. I forgive you for being so nice to me. It has a strange ring. Forgiveness also involves foregoing the right to punish the person who committed the wrong. It doesn't necessarily mean foregoing the right to take steps that will maybe help that person not do that same wrong in the future. That would be like reform. But inherent in the idea of forgiveness, I think, is the idea that punishment for the wrong is out of the question. Forgiveness also entails not holding the offense against the person who committed it. You can't forgive and hold a grudge, I don't think. Forgiveness, in part, is the letting go of the wrong as something that counts as kind of like in a ledger against that person in your relationship. And finally, forgiveness involves opening up the possibility of a restoration of relationship. It's a step that says, you are forgiven, that wrong no longer counts against you. I am here, ready for relationship. Jesus told a famous story that's recorded in the Gospel of Luke in chapter 15, and is often called the story of the prodigal son, that I think illustrates pretty well what goes on in an act of forgiveness. In this story, there's a young son who asks his dad, give me my half of the inheritance now. First of all, this is a huge affront in itself because the dad's not dead yet, and he's essentially wishing that his father were dead so he could have his forgiveness. He gets the inheritance, and he runs off and squanders it. He lives prodigally. At some point, the account in Luke says as he was wallowing in the pigsties, being jealous of the pigs for how much they had to eat, he realizes he has made a mistake. And he formulates a big speech that he's going to give to his dad when he goes home, and he's going to say, Dad, let me be just a wage laborer in your house, because I know you treat your wage laborers well, and that's better than the pigsty I'm coming from. So he goes back, he's rehearsing his story, and his father sees him in the distance and comes running out, ignoring all the codes of propriety and what's like the proper way for a father to behave towards a son, especially a son who has done this. And he hugs the son, and he prepares a banquet. And I take it what the father has done here is decided that that wrong, asking for the inheritance, running off and squandering it, doesn't count against his son. Relationship with his son is more important than the punishment that he could give the son. It's more important. Forgiveness opens the door for that son to be a son again rather than a wage laborer, for the restoration of that relationship. Now, some of you might be objecting, as many have, well, wait a second. In this case, the father's, apparently fairly wealthy. The son, all he's done is taken some of his property. It's not that big a deal. What about the cases when it's the powerless who are being wronged? What about the cases when forgiveness looks frankly dangerous? And I think this is an incredibly good objection. I think what we should take away from it is that there are some wrongs that, while they're not unforgivable, do tell us pretty seriously that the person who committed them is not able to engage in a healthy relationship at the moment. Restoration of the relationship can't happen unless the offender reforms in a serious way. So I think we can practice forgiveness even in these cases, but in the brokenness of the world in which we live, in a world in which there are such deep imbalances of power and so many possibilities of abuse, the restoration of a relationship doesn't have to happen necessarily right now. Sometimes the healing of a relationship has to wait until God has transformed that wrongdoer and has created a context in which the person who has been harmed is safe. We call that context the kingdom of God. And I think forgiveness today, even if it doesn't restore relationship, aims at the restoration that happens in the kingdom of God when we have been transformed, when wrongdoers have been transformed, and when the victims are safe. But nevertheless, see, forgiveness is a radical step today. Oftentimes, the wrongs done don't signal that the person who did them is not capable to be in a relationship at the moment. Oftentimes, indeed, forgiveness has the kind of counterintuitive potential not only to restore relationship, but to deepen it. Consider what happens when you go through the trial in a relationship of having done something wrong or having suffered a wrong, having named it and forgiven it. I, in my own experience, have found that those relationships come out deeper. They come out stronger. Something about taking that step, going through that fire, forges a stronger relationship and contributes to the richness of a life lived in relationship. So I don't know if any of you are convinced, but I'm going to assume for the moment that some of you are coming along with me at this point. Maybe the image of a life in which relationships get restored through forgiveness, through reconciliation, is beautiful and appealing to you. And you're ready to go. But that, you probably will have sensed, doesn't take care of how hard it is to forgive. That doesn't get rid of all those other options that you could have had were you sitting in Elbita's shoes in that story. It takes courage to forgive. Because forgiveness goes against our emotions. Forgiveness entails eventually letting go of anger. And I don't know about you guys, but fighting against anger is difficult. Somehow overruling your emotions, that's tough. Forgiveness, as I mentioned, it gives up the right to restitution. And it's hard to give things up, right? That's something you're owed. And you have to let go of it to forgive. Moreover, forgiveness risks future hurt. Relationship is risky. Opening the door for it is opening the door for the possibility that there will be more hurt in the future, that you'll have other things that you'll be called to forgive. And finally, I think this is really important in our culture, at least. Forgiveness is awkward. Talking about, like, the wrong thing that somebody did, having the gall to forgive them for it, doesn't that make you seem so superior? Like, who wants to have that conversation? I know I don't. I would much rather just kind of let things slide by. They'll take care of themselves in the long run. I'll take whatever reasonable measures I need to take to protect myself, make sure this doesn't happen again. I'm good. Having that awkward conversation is a challenge. Because of all these things, I think forgiveness takes courage. And that, for those of you who've been coming over the summer, will be a signal that this is indeed part of our mega series on courage. So, I did a little thinking. I was trying to figure out what sort of practices could we engage in? What can we do that might give us that courage, that might help us get over some of these obstacles and become the sort of people who can forgive? So, first thing I thought of was the anger issue, dealing with emotions. Now, there are a number of psalms in the Hebrew Bible that, if you read through them, don't seem to be too keen on forgiveness. They're all about God really just taking revenge on the person who's harmed you. We could either take that as a cue that everything I said earlier and all the other stuff I said is a reason we might want to forgive is just wrong. In fact, we should want revenge. Or we can consider a different possibility, which I think might be a better one. Miroslav Volf, a professor here at Yale, writes concerning these psalms, dealing with the question of what to do with the violent imagery. What he writes does not seem to have made it into the slideshow. So pay careful attention. He writes, for the followers of the crucified Messiah, the main message of these psalms is this. Rage belongs before God. not in the reflectively managed and manicured form of a confession, but as a pre-reflective outburst from the depths of the soul. That is to say, don't get yourself in order and then go to God and say, oh God, I was so angry and that was wrong. But go to God as an angry person and say, God, this is horrible. By placing this unattended rage, he says, before God, we place both our unjust enemy, note there that this is naming a wrong, our unjust enemy, and our own vengeful self face to face with a God who loves and does justice. This is bringing our anger to God, unmitigated, not covered up, not made to look nice, and laying it at God's feet. That, I think, is a step that we can take. If my life is any indication, it is not a magic step. Praying in anger before God does not immediately and always resolve that anger, but it is a step. It is part of the process that will prepare us to be people who can forgive. A second thing that I'd like to suggest here is that one of the first steps in being able to forgive is actually to get good at being forgiven. To have the courage to be forgiven is to learn some things that will help us be the sort of people who can forgive. There's a saying of Jesus recorded in the Gospel of Matthew that I think speaks to this. He's speaking about a judging, and he says, why do you see the speck in your neighbor's eye, but do not notice the log in your own eye? How can you say to your neighbor, let me take the speck out of your eye, while the log is in your eye? You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your neighbor's eye. Now notice, Jesus is not saying, ignore the speck in your neighbor's eye. By the way, I take it that the speck and the log are indicative of wrongdoings or character flaws or something of that sort. Jesus is not saying, pretend your neighbor hasn't wronged you. He's saying, unless you've seen the log in your eye, the wrong you've done, the relationship you've broken, and unless you've attended to that, you likely won't have the ability to deal lovingly with the speck in your neighbor's eye. I think it goes something like this. Being forgiven entails naming when we have been in the wrong. It's the reverse side of naming the wrong, right? If you're forgiving, you're naming a wrong that's been done to you. If you're being forgiven, you have to name that a wrong has been done by you. Moreover, it attunes us to the need for forgiveness. To recognize a wrong that we've done puts us in the position of knowing what it's like to be in need, knowing what it's like to be unable to undo that, to need forgiveness. It attunes us to the care, moreover, with which specks and logs need to be removed from eyes. It's a delicate business, forgiveness. There's a lot of vulnerability there. And being on the side of the forgiven attunes us to that. But I imagine you say, well, okay, you've told us that forgiveness is hard, so practice being forgiven. But how is that any easier? Like you just said, to accept forgiveness is to admit that you were in the wrong, but it's much easier not to do that, simply to deny it. The philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche had this to say about wrongdoing. I really love this little saying. He says, I did that, says my memory. I could not have done that, says my pride, and remains inexorable. Eventually, the memory yields. Which is to say, you find a way of thinking it through without remembering that you were in the wrong. Now, this, I think, is an extreme case. We don't necessarily forget what we've done entirely or pretend that we didn't do it at all. But I at least have a really striking power to simply change the description of what I've done so that it goes from being a wrong to something not so bad. For example, I wasn't insulting you. I wasn't being mean to you. I was simply helping you see the hard truth. I wasn't being negligent, ignoring you, not caring for you. I was simply working for something that, in fact, is more important for both of us. I don't know, does that ring a bell? Maybe we haven't gone the full-on Nietzschean route. Maybe we know we're in the wrong. Memory is still holding up against pride. But we'd like to avoid, again, the social embarrassment of admitting that we were wrong. This is another one. I'm excellent at this. So you try to make up for it, right? You've done it wrong, you know about it. You try to make up for it by being extra nice, maybe giving a lot of gifts, whether physical or some other, you know, being especially attentive, as if there's some kind of balance, right? Like, I'm gonna be so good that wrong just eventually, you know, is done with. But I would suggest this too is excluded when we accept forgiveness. Forgiveness does entail facing up to the wrong we've done. Accepting forgiveness, I think, is also challenging because not only does it name your wrong as wrong, it entails a commitment to change. It says, I will not do this in the future. I will aim to be different. I will aim not to have this harm come into our relationship. Which again, is difficult. That's a judgment on the thing that you've done. Accepting that judgment is rejecting what has been and turning towards something new. Now, when Heidi and I learned the truth about Albita, we were devastated. This totally blew apart our entire view of what had been going on, and we felt guilty. We had slandered an innocent woman, a complete stranger at that. We'd never met her before yelling at her. Our pride was wounded, right? How could we have not been right about this? How could we not have known? And on top of that, we had done something wrong. Now, in this moment of guilt, we saw, I think through God's grace, like the huge plank that was in our eye. This was like 4x6 plank. And Heidi did something surprising. She looked at me and she said, we have to go to Albita's house and apologize. I didn't know where Albita's house was. She didn't know where Albita's house was. But we were going, because Heidi said so. And also because she was right, but. So we found out eventually by asking mutual acquaintances where she lived, and we went to Albita's door. We rang the bell and nobody answered. I breathed a sigh of relief because we had gotten out of it. But then, finally, an indigenous woman came to the door. This was Albita's housekeeper and dear friend. And it turned out she told us Albita was not home. Now, we surmise, given how close Albita and this woman are, that she knew who we were. What other 20, 21-year-old gringos were coming out to this part of town to knock on Albita's door? But nevertheless, she said yes, we could come in and wait for her, and she even offered us some tea. So we sat there in Albita's living room, waiting and terrified. Oh, if only you knew Albita, you would know how terrified we were. Eventually, she came home, and she walks across the room to a chair that was on the other side from where Heidi and I were sitting. And she stands there, and she looks at us with those killer, fiery eyes, and waits. And Heidi, tearfully, begins to explain. She says, this is what we had thought about her, and we were so wrong. And we shouldn't have jumped to conclusions, and we should have talked to you. and we were wrong. Can you forgive us? Albita had been listening patiently, just keeping her eyes locked on us. And then, when Heidi was done, she folded her hands and she told us how much she loved Santiago, how much she loved this town, and how hard she worked for its benefit. She told us how much it hurt when we slandered her, how much it hurt to have somebody accuse her of not loving this town, of doing something that she hadn't done. And then she did something astounding. She too began to cry as she said that it was clear that we too loved Santiago, that we loved this town and were trying to work for it. She said she forgave us for wronging her, and she said she looked forward to working together as friends for the benefit of Santiago. Isn't that amazing? She didn't excuse us. She didn't say, oh, it was no big deal, all just some misunderstanding. But she saw the good, that little bit of good in what we'd done, that urge to defend Santiago, that love that was in some part motivating us. And she highlighted that while judging the wrong and forgiving us for it. And that was the foundation of a relationship that we still have 6 years later. When we go to Guatemala, we see Albita as often as we can. We work together for the good of Santiago whenever an opportunity presents itself. So that is my case for forgiveness, for forgiving and being forgiven. It's the sort of thing that can take disasters and turn them into relationships. It's the sort of thing that can bear fruit that you cannot imagine. So I'd like to invite you guys. I forgot. That's Heidi and Albita with Manuelito as well, collaborating outside the very community house where they had been engaging in their shouting match. So I'd like to give you guys some practical invitations. What might this week look like as people who have the courage to forgive and to be forgiven? First, I would encourage you to ask, to reflect. Is there something for which you haven't accepted or asked for forgiveness? Is there something that you've done, a relationship that you've broken, that you've been pretending wasn't wrong, or that you've been trying to make up for or ignoring or hoping will fade away? If so, pray. Pray for the courage to ask for forgiveness. I would encourage you to take advantage of the prayer time we'll have later to pray with somebody else, to get that out in the open before at least somebody, and to bring it before God. Secondly, I would ask, is there something that you haven't forgiven? Is there something that you're dwelling on, something that hurt you? Something that's hard to get over the anger? Something that perhaps you've been pretending wasn't a big deal, but keeps kind of coming up in your mind and nagging on you. You feel yourself pulling away a bit from the person involved in that relationship. If you still have anger about some sort of wrong like this, I'd encourage you to pray through Psalm 35. It's one of those psalms that brings anger to God. And it might feel counterintuitive at the start, to be praying for God to bring justice on that enemy. But my hunch is that God will do surprising things with that prayer. I would again, in this case, encourage you to end that prayer when you've prayed the psalm, when you brought your anger before God, by asking God for the courage to forgive the person in question. Finally, well, not quite finally, but One of the big ones. Reach out. Ask for or offer forgiveness. That right there takes some courage. But it's where we're going with this, I think. It's what we're aiming at. Finally, I'd invite you to come now as we celebrate communion, Christian practice. It's a feast of forgiveness. It has its origins on the night that Jesus was betrayed to the Roman authorities. He was executed the following day. Jesus was eating with some of his closest friends and followers, one of whom was to betray him. And while they were eating, Jesus took a loaf of bread, and after blessing it, he broke it and gave it to these disciples. And he said, "Take, eat. This is my body." Then he took a cup, and after giving thanks, he gave it to them, saying, "Drink from it, all of you, for this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins." So if you're a follower of Jesus, or if you'd like to begin following Jesus, if you'd like to begin a life marked by things like forgiveness and reconciliation, I invite you to come forward and take a piece of the bread and dip it in the cup and let the story of Jesus who forgave even those who crucified him, let that story begin to shape you for a life of courage, for a life of forgiving, and for a life of being forgiven.